Welcome to the Strong Starts podcast with your hosts, Jessica Whitehead and Sarah Gerber-Kai.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Strong Starts podcast. Thank you all for listening, subscribing, and following us on social media. We are at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. And Jessica, one of our posts on social media actually got quite a bit of traction. It was a post about restraints, and it was tied to episode 4 that we did on restraint and seclusion. And this post got quite a few views, but also quite a few comments and questions, and some folks wanting some clarity around our position on restraint and seclusion. And so we thought we could dedicate an episode just to addressing some of those questions and concerns. And one of the kind of themes, Jessica, was around when do we restrain and seclude, wanting some real clarity around that. And I know we can't give kind of a very black and white answer. If this happens, then of course you restrain. If this happens, then you seclude. It's typically more nuanced than that. But what are your thoughts around giving our listeners some clarity?
You know, it's really tricky. And restraint and isolation brings up some heavy feelings, some pretty strong opinions at the same time. And it's not black and white. We have words in our policies and our laws like imminent danger, serious risk, and those are open to interpretation. So in the moment, as things are, you know, going a little crazy around us, we have to say, oh my gosh, we have to step back and be able to say, is this imminent danger? Is the student at serious risk right now? One of the comments that was made was around if there's a potential for loss of life. Well, you know, we had a situation where a student was able to make it out the front doors of our school, which is on a busy road, and make it pretty close to the parking lot as a car was coming around. I did not hesitate to catch up to that student, restrain that student, and carry them from the parking lot to the sidewalk. So that is a restraint that I feel justified in doing. I don't have any guilt in doing that restraint. I still didn't like doing the restraint, though. It never feels good for me to put hands on kids. And so we think of situations like that, where our gut is telling us, oh my gosh, something bad's going to happen if I don't do this. And in that situation, I would say, in the opinion of Jessica, I would say that that is a warranted restraint.
Okay. That seems pretty clear cut to me too, but you just mentioned your gut told you to do it. So what about when I have a kid climbing up on the table and I start to panic a bit and my gut tells me I need to get this kid off the table now. I need to restrain them and pull them down.
Well, yes. And I wonder, that is great to point out. I did say my gut told me that at the first
one. Yes, ma'am.
But yes, why is my gut telling me that a kid being on a table is dangerous? And what am I comparing that to? So if I say, oh my gosh, this kid is on a table, if he jumps off, he's going to get seriously injured, so I must restrain. Why would that be considered dangerous? But if a kid is on the playground and climbing up the playground equipment, which may be even higher, your gut is not telling you to restrain at that point. So I would kind of evaluate these situations and really have some thinking around what is truly dangerous for the student in this situation. So, you know, if a student is running down the hallway, are you going to restrain? Because they could trip and fall. We've had that happen where a student is running, trips, falls, you know, gets a bloody nose. We don't restrain that student. I have a student who, you know, breaks the rules at recess and jumps off the swing. I don't run over and restrain that student. So I think, yes, our gut is telling us that it might be wrong, but why? And how do we compare that to other situations as well?
Yes. And it sounds like from what you're processing or helping us process through is that it might be more about adult anxiety than it is about the child's behavior sometimes?
Well, yes, I think so too. I think sometimes we get heightened and our amygdala is firing in that moment. And it might not just be about the table, right? It could be because earlier, you know, that student was throwing things and we had to move other students out of the way. That student might have hit a staff member earlier. And so we're just done, right? And oh my gosh, now he's on the table, and now I have to do something about all of this behavior. And in order to make the behavior stop, I'm going to restrain. So is it really about the table, or is it about how we're feeling in the moment?
Yeah, and it's it's not to say, because I can see how this could come across as maybe like diminishing or talking down to adults' experiences. And I don't want to do that. I don't mean to do that, but only to say that these situations can become very stressful, especially if you're thinking, you know, if you think about that student, maybe whose problem behavior makes you go home and cry every day or just feel so frustrated, so angry and so stuck. Of course, our anxiety, our escalation is going to be like a little bit higher. We might even be co-escalating in situations like that. So I could see how it's not just about a student being on a table, but what else is going on that is making my gut say that I need to restrain or I need to completely control this student.
Absolutely. And I don't, yes, I agree. I don't want everyone to think we're dismissing or minimizing what's happened. Mm-hmm. We know we're in it. And we see a lot of shit happening around us. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is a concern and concerns are valid. I think it's how we're responding to the actions that are really key here, because we can still have these big feelings. It's just like we tell kids, right? You're allowed to be angry. It's how you're angry that makes a difference. We're allowed to be frustrated. We're allowed to be upset. We're allowed to even be triggered by what's happening around us.
Totally.
But what we do as a response is really important.
And one thing that was also coming up a lot is folks concerned that what we are suggesting is that staff should just take on violence. If a kid is kicking, hitting, biting them, that they should just take it and accept it. And that's absolutely not what we mean either. I definitely don't want any staff to be put in danger or feel like they have to be harmed or potentially injured in the process of reducing restraint and isolation.
Yeah, I hope no one's feeling like they're a punching bag, because that's an awful feeling, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to have to go to work and get the crap beat out of us every day. No one really, well, maybe there's a select few, but no one I know really signs up for that. We're not paid enough to be punching bags either. And so I think that, you know, when it gets to that point, we really have to look at the systemic issue behind this whole thing. So if we're coming to work and daily this student is attacking us, or we're put in this room and we're getting hit, we're getting kicked, we're getting bit or being spit at, we need to start digging into why that's happening so much and why people are feeling this way. And I really think that that's when we have to take a step back and we have to start looking at preventative measures, because no one should come to work. No one should be that anxious to come to work because they're going to get beat up by kids. It's not healthy. It's not good for education. It's not good for students, staff, any stakeholder that's involved.
Okay, so like let's kind of talk through a scenario here, because I want to get kind of a clear picture of what this would look like, kind of give folks a clear picture. So let's say we have our student, Jessica, and every day before lunch and typically before the end of the day, at least once, Jessica has what we might kind of observe or call a tantrum. But what it really looks like is Jessica becomes frustrated. She's sitting in math class. She becomes frustrated. She's trying to get help, but for whatever reason can't communicate that she's needing help. And so she starts throwing things off her desk. She's throwing her tools around the room. Maybe she pushes over her desk, like literally topples it over, and then tries to leave the room. If this is happening, where do you start in terms of looking at the system?
Well, and this is a reality, right? We have this happening. You and I have dealt with a situation like this where it's, you know, a common occurrence for this one student. And we're collecting, we have all this data saying, oh my gosh, at this time of the day, it's happening a lot during this. We really have to step back and look at that time and what's affecting that student. You know, it might not be 10 o'clock every day, but it might be anytime there's independent work, or, you know, it might be before recess because just the transition out to a large group of kids is stressful for that student. So one thing to look at is a pattern. And, you know, I've been in meetings where even I have said, I can't find a pattern. I guarantee you there's some sort of pattern somewhere. We just haven't found it. You know, there's some reason behind it. No one just goes off for no reason whatsoever. And so I think we really have to start looking at the needs of the kids at that, you know, are their needs getting met? And they're obviously not if their response is destroying a room, toppling desks, kicking, hitting, punching.
Yeah. And this has been some of the most fruitful discussions we've had is when we're sitting around a table with multiple specialists. who can really see this from multiple angles. So it's always really helpful. You know, I know we work with our speech pathologists a lot because they can help us to understand where communication breakdowns in communication might be happening, where additional assistance with language might be needed. So I might be thinking about this student, Jessica, and wondering, okay, what is she trying to communicate through her behavior? How can we assist her in finding some replacement ways to communicate some and meet her where she's at in terms of her language and communication? I know, though, that we've also looked at how can we better respond then? Like, let's say that let's say the system is trying to figure things out. Well, we know that takes time. In the meantime, are we comfortable just restraining and isolating Jessica every time she has her problem behavior?
Well, I'm going to say that I'm not. So, you know, there was a moment, and it was a kind of a turning point for me. And I will not get into too many details, but there was a turning point with a student that I was restraining and another staff member was restraining. There was some influence on me to do this restraint. And that was the moment in my head that I said, I'm never doing this again. And the only time since that moment it has been if a student goes in the parking lot. Unfortunately, yeah. That's happened a couple times. But there was a point in me that said, I can't do this to myself. I can't do this to a student. And I can't do this to the students and the staff around me. It was traumatizing for everybody. You know, once I had that in my head, I wasn't going to do it. I was really motivated to find things to do instead of a restraint. Once I took that tool out of my toolbox, I knew I had to replace it with others. And so I started to figure out, okay, I'm not going to restrain this kid. No one in this room, we're not going to restrain him anymore. This is what it's doing to him and everybody else. So instead, as a collective, let's make a plan. No one disagreed. We were in a room and it was just a strong consensus, which was great. And so we came up with things like, okay, we're going to move kids to the other area. We're going to restrict his access to this. Hey, we know this triggers him when he does this. We're going to be mindful of that and do some pre-teaching. We're not going to wait for a blow up anymore. And the biggest thing is we are going to wait him out. When he gets upset, we're going to wait him out. We're going to give him as much space as we possibly can, clear what we can, and we're going to wait him out. And it didn't take very long for him to catch on. Know that that was our plan, and his behavior improved after that. But I think, you know, it's what tools we choose to use and what tools we choose to keep in our toolbox.
Yes. Well, and you all made that commitment and then you were accountable to one another once you made it as a team. I think that's a really important piece when we're talking about this type of work of reducing restraint and seclusion, is that we keep saying it needs to happen within the system because the system has to hold us then accountable to trying to find alternative tools. And the system really should be supporting us in finding those. You know, I know that you sought out opportunities, Jessica, to learn other ways of de-escalating students, but then also like real trauma-informed practices, and the system supported you in doing that. And I imagine you wouldn't have been able to make the headway that you did with your team if not for that support from within the system.
No, and that was probably an even bigger deal than me putting my foot down. And I feel weird saying I put my foot down, but I really did. Like, this is not okay. But I'm also not one to bring a problem to the table and not have any ideas on how to work through that problem. So I said, hey, guys, we're not going to do this. I did some research on other methods and I brought papers and websites. And here's all the things we could do instead. But I'm only one person, right? It did take a lot. And so in the moment, you know, we, like you said, we didn't have everything to stop it that day, but we worked on it. We tried one thing while we're researching and becoming trained in something else. What can we do in the meantime? We implemented little things along the way.
Well, and it can get pretty intensive, these plans. When we actually start to dive into meeting student needs, we can uncover quite a bit because there's so many students who get the large number of their needs met at school. For a variety of reasons, those needs aren't being met at home. And so they get those needs met at school. And so when we're developing these plans to support students, while we're filling up our toolkit, sometimes we have to really pull back quite a bit. Even if our goal ultimately is a student in the classroom 100% of the time, receiving all general education, sometimes we have to actually slow down quite a bit and pull back in order to provide that kind of additional instruction or intervention, make sure students have access to all the sensory tools that they need, make sure that they have felt safety and security. They have the adults that keep them safe. I mean, there's a lot. The list goes on, Jessica. Help me out.
Well, and it's true. And I think what I encourage people who are thinking, oh, you're crazy about this no restraint situation. Mm-hmm. I encourage them to just, even if they're going to continue restraints and isolations, still really evaluate the systems that you have in place and how are preventing this. So one thing that we've worked on as a team, and not just Sarah and I, it's taken a whole village around us, but we've really looked at what needs are and are not being met. Okay, so we have this student and it is room clear after room clear. It is restraint after restraint. What is happening? Okay, they don't know how to ask for help. Well, that's a whole skill issue that we really have to work on. It's a life skill anyway, so we should be working on it, whether or not that student's in special education, right?
Yes.
You know, if they're frustrated because the work is too difficult, that's another skill. I mean, I know as an adult, if I have work that's difficult, I don't want to do it. But we expect kids to. So what can we do when they get frustrated with their work? And how can we build that skill? We have to remember that students don't always get these skill building pieces at home. So they come to us not knowing how to ask for help, right? They don't know what to do when something's hard and to persevere and to have grit. And they might see at home when the person at home might be flipping a table because they're frustrated. Mm-hmm. So it's our responsibility to really evaluate those needs and look at the skills that they might need.
Yes. At the end of the day, we're educators. Plain and simple. And if a student has a skill that they need to learn, because guess what? No kid is born knowing how to cooperate, knowing how to persevere through challenging tasks, and knowing how to sit still and listen. So if we want students to have these skills, we're going to have to teach them.
Yes. And it might be a different need as well. So let's take a student who is climbing on a cabinet, because this table, counter, cabinet thing seems to be a hot topic. They're climbing on a cabinet because above the cabinet is a shelf. And on this shelf is the coolest toy you've ever seen. And that student wants it all day long. But you tell the student, okay, well, first we're going to get our work done, which I already cringe about the use of work. But first we're going to get work done and then we're going to get access to the toy. Well, if that work is really difficult and the student knows, well, I could either do the work or I can just climb on the cabinet and get that toy myself, then they're thinking they can meet their own need of play by climbing the cabinet instead of doing the work. So when we think of needs being met, well, there is a need for the student to play, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. A kid is allowed to have that need.
Yes.
And we want them to accomplish work. Well, we can look at a few different things. How can we increase the student's success with that work? Or we can also look at the environment around. Maybe that toy shouldn't even be in the vicinity. Maybe that toy should be somewhere else that we can go get. Maybe that shelf should just come down. Like, is it a hazard? Are they hanging from that shelf? I mean, I've been in a room where people have told me that. I said, well, just take the shelf down. Do we really need the shelf? We don't want the kid climbing on it. So we take it down, right? And that reduces access. And so I think we can look at environmental factors. We can look at individual needs. How are we setting things up in the environment? I know if a student has a tendency to destroy things around them, I'm not going to keep, you know, a prized heirloom sitting out and provide access to that. And so I'm just going to monitor what's in the room. What does the student have access to? Where can they go? How do they get what they need?
Okay. But then, like, let's say if that kid is kicking you every time to get a toy, or let's just say snacks. Kid wants snacks. Kid is hungry. You say, oh, snack time in 10 minutes. And kid just like comes at you. If I give them the snack, isn't that then reinforcing that, oh, yes, you hit to get snacks?
Yes. And that kid is hangry, right? We get hangry. They want a snack. They start kicking us and we give them a snack. Then they know, oh, I kick, I get snack, right? That's just what we taught. But the hard thing is, too, can you imagine as an adult, like you're sitting at home and you're hungry and someone at your house, a significant other, partner, child, whatever, is at your house and said, okay, you can have your food in 10 minutes. You got to get work done first. I'm like, please. That would not make me happier. True. And that actually wouldn't motivate me to get any more housework done. Because I tell you what, I will drop that vacuum to go get my snack. So I agree that the kids should not kick and then get a snack for kicking. But I also think we could set up that snack routine a little differently. We can also look at the need of that, you know, needs of that child, and also look at the child as a person, as a human at home. Mm-hmm. Are they withheld food? Do they not have access for food? So when they don't get food at school, they view that as a threat. Like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have access to food. And so that could also be a trauma response that we have to be aware of. And so them kicking to get that food, that is what they need. That is their safety, right? And so we're keeping that from them. Again, I don't think kids should be kicking people, but I think we really need to use some trauma-informed practices at that point. And on top of that, say a kid is kicking you and you know it's because they want a snack and you're like, crap, I should probably give them a snack, but I don't want to reward the kicking. See if you can get them to do anything else. So they're kicking you, and you say, okay, I'm going to get you that snack, but first, you know, just sit in your chair or put your feet down. What you're actually doing is rewarding the feet down. Oh, thank you for putting your feet down. Thank you for sitting down in your chair. You know, thank you for, and you get them to take a deep breath. Thank you for taking a deep breath. And the snack follows that desired behavior versus, oh my gosh, you're kicking, here's your snack.
And I appreciate you bringing up the trauma piece, because sometimes trauma response doesn't always look very straightforward. Like we might think, okay, well, the kid has enough food at home. Why is so much emotion being activated when I withhold food? But it's possible that the student has had some experience of loss or of feeling out of control of themselves because of something else. And so it's more like that emotion, that feeling of feeling out of control or of having something being withheld from them, that's actually what's triggering the response. There's just something that I know we've seen in some students when we're looking at patterns. Sometimes we have to really think creatively and think out of the box about the why. But yes, what you're saying makes a lot of sense in terms of meeting student needs. What if it's something like wanting to go home? Like that's what they want. And they're like throwing chairs to get to go home. How do I meet that need?
Right. Okay, this is tricky because then we think, okay, they're throwing chairs, they want to go home. They even might use some physical aggression type behaviors to try to get to go home. And a lot of times they reach the point to where they may even get suspended and then they're sent home. So, you know, it's the same argument people use. If they kick and they get a snack, you know, are they going to keep kicking? Well, if they kick and get to go home and that's where they want to go, then they're going to keep kicking to go home because that's where they want to go. They want to go home. They just, you know, especially if they just started kindergarten, they just came from a whole, you know, birth through five of being able to be, you know, around their toys at home and play at home. They get snack whenever they want at home. And then all of a sudden they come to school, snack is scheduled. They have to sit in a desk or a table. And you know what? Sometimes I just want to go home too during the day. Yes. So that's really where preventative measures come in. It's also how we're addressing their feelings about going home. Oh, you just can't go home. How can we validate? Hey, I know you want to go home. Let's look at how much time there is to go home. Can we make sure they have a photo of parents, or can they bring a comfort item with them to school from home? I know we have a couple kids that have their, you know, special stuffy at home. And well, can they bring a part of home with them to school? Can we do countdowns where they cross out time? Even for the older kids, you have the older kids that want to go home too, right? Because then they can play video games. But yes, we do have to be careful that they will escalate the behaviors in order to get sent home. And we send them home to reinforce that behavior.
Well, and it's incredible how creative you can start to get with trying to figure out student plans once you've really made the commitment to be trauma-informed, be equitable, reduce your suspensions, reduce restraint and isolation. There's a lot of different things that we can do to try to, I mean, at a very like human level, to try to meet students' needs. And I think, too, about what felt sense of safety do they have at home? What connection do they have at home? And how can we meet that at school? And I know folks get tired of hearing like about building relationships with students. You know, have you built a relationship with a student? I know it becomes tiresome to hear it, but for some students, that really is like a big piece of what it is that they're needing, is they're just needing that deep connection with some adults, with some safe adults at school.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we think of school and we think of a place where kids and staff and everyone there feels like they belong. Mm-hmm. Really, when we do things like restraint and isolation, it's putting that at jeopardy. It's putting relationships at jeopardy. There's a perception of safety or not being safe. And so I know that even after we post this and we talk about it a little more on social media, we'll probably get some comments. But I do hope we give people some thoughts to consider. Are we using practices that build positive relationships, that build trust, that build a place where kids want to be and want to stay? Because if they don't want to be there, they're going to show you in some way that they don't want to be there. We want to help provide tools, provide ideas, and we want to bring awareness to what is happening.
Yes, absolutely. And so on that note, we're going to start posting more reviews of tools that we find helpful and resources and things on social media. So be sure to follow us at Strong Starts on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. We'll also be participating in a webinar on Tier 1 systems for behavior, how to develop those. Take a look in our show notes for the link to that webinar. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.